It's 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Mexican officials have expressed their concerns with two visiting U.S. cabinet secretaries about U.S. threats of deportations and the building of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly met with their counterparts in Mexico City. Secretary Tillerson spoke with reporters.
During the course of our meetings, we discussed the breadth of challenges and opportunities in the U.S.-Mexico relationship. Although our two nations share a long history, our visit was forward-looking, focusing on common interests that would advance security and economic well-being.
Visit by the Trump administration officials came at time when it seemed that it was a low point of relations between the two countries, which have enjoyed peace along their 3,100-kilometer-long common border since the 1840s. President Trump has repeatedly insisted that Mexico, one way or another, must pay for a border wall, which lawmakers in Washington estimate would cost at least $12 billion. And just this week, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security outlined policies that could result in the deportation of millions of undocumented immigrants. U.S.-backed forces retaking control of the airport in the Iraqi city of Mosul. It's been controlled by the Islamic State since 2014. This would give the Iraqis access to the city from the southwest and, for the first time, control in the area along the west bank of the Tigris. United Nations Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, met with Syrian government delegation and envoys for the opposition in Geneva. This is VOA News. White House strategist Steve Bannon says U.S. conservatives can expect a daily fight with the news media and others in the opposition. Bannon was one of the main speakers on the second day of the Conservative Political Action Conference in the Washington area. Vice President Mike Pence also spoke to the CPAC conference. He spoke about U.S.-Israeli relations.
Israel's fight is our fight. Her cause is our cause. Her values are our values. And under President Trump, America will stand with Israel.
President Trump will speak to the group later today. Trump administration has ordered a review of U.S. policy toward North Korea, looking at the options Washington has for its future dealings with Pyongyang and the leadership. A number of experts believe a nuclear-armed North Korea presents President Trump's administration with one of its most urgent and potentially explosive problems. Malaysian police said today an investigation would be carried out into how two women procured a nerve agent, which was then allegedly smeared on the face of the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at Kuala Lumpur Airport. Malaysian investigators say Kim Jong-nam died on February 13, shortly after the women put a substance on his face while he was checking in for a flight. Khalid Abu Bakr is Malaysia's Inspector General for Police.
We need the next of kin to come and identify the body, to identify who is deceased, and we would then like to take the DNA sample from the next of kin.
Police have not said how the women were able to apply the nerve gas without themselves becoming ill. World Health Organization reporting depression is increasing worldwide and is now the leading cause of global disability. Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports more than 300 million people, or more than 4% of the global population, were living with depression in 2015. The numbers mark an 18% increase over a 10-year period. Dan Chisholm is health systems advisor in the WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse and a lead author of the report. He says depression is a disorder that can affect anyone at any point in that person's life.
If you look at the prevalence of different disorders around the world and you look at the disability that is associated with them, if you combine those together, depression ends up at the top of the list.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you can get more news by going to our website, voanews.com.
OA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, February 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria calls on South Africa to protect the lives and properties of Nigerians living in South Africa in the wake of rising xenophobic violence.
We absolutely insisted on the authorities there in South Africa taking steps to ensure the security of lives and properties of Nigerians living in South Africa.
Jeffrey Onyema is the Nigerian foreign minister. We'll look at the widespread effects of anti-immigrant violence in South Africa. Heads of religious schools in Cameroon's English-speaking region try to resolve the country's ongoing educational crisis. And yet another official of South Sudan President Salva Kiir's government has resigned.
There is no political will. The violation of human rights is continuing where in Equatoria, in Greater Equatoria, Greater Upper Nile and Western Bahr al-Ghazal.
That's Lieutenant General Gabriel Diop Bouf-Lam, former Minister of Labor, Public Service and Human Resource Developer of South Sudan. And a Malawian wine merchant finds success that boosts his community. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's post in our Black History Month and African History Facts and Contest are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria has called on the South African government to take all possible measures to ensure the security of lives and properties of Nigerians living in South Africa. Nigerian Foreign Minister Jeffrey Onyema says the South African government should also address inflammatory remarks by some political leaders, as well as possible complicity of some police officers in attacks against Nigerians. There has been an uptick in xenophobic violence against businesses and homes owned by foreigners in some South African cities, including Pretoria. The Nigerian government on Thursday summoned the South African ambassador to Nigeria to express its strongest displeasure over the situation. Foreign Minister Onyema says Nigeria abhors xenophobia and wants those responsible to be brought to book and reparations made to victims.
We absolutely insisted on the authorities there in South Africa taking steps to ensure the security of lives and properties of Nigerians living in South Africa, and that steps should be taken to address the situation of what we understand as some inflammatory remarks by some political leaders there, and also to look into, investigate allegations of some possible complicity of certain police officers, or at least the passiveness towards during these attacks. So expressed in the strongest term possible our profound displeasure at what had taken place, and really seeking guarantees that the authorities would do much more in ensuring, as I said, the safety and of lives and protection of lives and property, and also that the offenders should be brought to book and that there should be adequate reparations for the victims.
Mr. Minister, is this the view of your government, that the South African government is not doing much to protect Nigerians living in South Africa? So I'm interested in knowing what was the response of the South African ambassador.
We did not state that it was inadequate what they were doing. What we were saying is that this is what has happened, you know, and clearly we wanted, and it's not the first time that it's happened, and so we really wanted some assurance of the safety. And the reaction of the South African was, of course, a formal apology for what had taken place, and, you know, that the government of South Africa absolutely condemned these actions, and that they in no way represented the position or the attitude of the South African government towards, you know, the Nigerians living in their country. And, you know, of course, highlighting the excellent relations between the two governments at every level. So we don't blame as such the South African government, and we're not doing so. The problem is that this has been recurring, these instances of these kinds of attacks.
These days, you look around, it seems to me that the world is closing in We see a lot of refugees. Some people resent refugees. Nigeria being one of the populous countries in Africa, any view on what's going on?
Well, it's something that we absolutely abhor. Our feeling is that, you know, there've been refugees since time immemorial. I mean, that's what has, you know, made the world what it is today. And we absolutely abhor xenophobia. And in the cases where there have been attacks on Nigerians, you know, we have stepped in very quickly and engaged with the government at the very highest level to take steps to protect the Nigerians. And in some cases, we've been successful in ensuring that adequate compensation has been paid. But, you know, it's a universal problem, xenophobia, when allied with acute poverty and economic issues.
That's Nigerian Foreign Minister Geoffrey Onyema speaking with me from Abuja. Xenophobic violence has returned to South Africa with recent attacks on foreign-owned shops in the capital, Pretoria. But as viewers Anita Powell learned when she visited the destroyed businesses, the roots of this anger are deep and complex, and the consequences of the violence affect more than just foreigners.
Bigglesworth Chimango ran this successful African restaurant for 6 months. But now he is shutting it down, just days after his neighbor's shop in this Pretoria neighborhood was trashed by angry residents who accused foreigners of bringing in crime and taking away jobs. Residents say this shop was run by a Pakistani family. They fled after this week's attack. And Chimango, who is Zimbabwean, says he does not want to be next.
That's why I decided, like, it's not safe anymore. As you can see, my neighbor, just next door, they just looted everything from his shop. And I mainly believe these are just, like, ordinary thugs. It's not like every South African who wants these people out. But there are people who are frustrated about having jobs and thinking that all the foreigners, they come here to take their jobs.
The violence has also affected local business people. This South African-owned restaurant was also forced to close because of the chaos. They opened days later, but with no food to sell.
On Monday, they came in, they told me to close the shop. I said, why? They said, if we don't, we're going to break the entrance, those gates, and then everything. Even at the gate, if you can check, the gate is broken. They break everything. They use my gate, they use my entrance to go to that Pakistani shop to break at the back.
Xenophobic violence is not new to South Africa, which is a magnet for migrants from around Africa. Attacks in 2015 left at least 7 people dead. Nor are the underlying causes new. Systemic inequality, high unemployment, and racism have plagued South Africa since the end of apartheid in 1994. Activists blame the government.
It's just very interesting that since 1994, our unemployment levels have stayed at between 25 to now 30%. You can't blame foreign nationals for that unemployment level. It's chronic systemic unemployment. What is our government doing to create, put in place policies that allow for decent jobs?
Chimango said he had a solution. About half of his small restaurant staff were South Africans. Now they, like him, are gone. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 24th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. There has been yet another resignation from South Sudan President Salva Kiir's government. The latest is Lieutenant General Gabriel Diouf Bouthlam, National Minister of Labor, Public Service and Human Resource Development. In a letter, Lieutenant General Bouthlam accused President Kiir and his inner circle of lacking the political will to implement the peace agreement. He also accused the Sudan People's Liberation Army of, quote, daily human rights violations and crimes against humanity in the country. No official of the South Sudan government was immediately available for comment. Lieutenant General Bouthlam tells viewers John Tanza that President Kiir's national dialogue has no clear agenda and lacks inclusivity.
There is no political will. The violation of human rights is continuing where in Equatoria, in Greater Equatoria, Greater Upper Nile and Western Bahr al-Ghazal. So when you talk about peace, you should not talk at the same time about war. I am originally from the SLMIO, but we were two hostages. That's why I remained in Juba that time.
And who took you hostage in Juba?
It is not myself alone. It is all the entire leadership of the SPLM-IO. You know, when we remain in Juba, Juba being controlled by the SPLM in government. And of course, when the forces of the Torium were pushed out from Juba, the entire cabinet of the SPLM-IO remained in Juba, where General Taban is having a conspiracy, a direct conspiracy with the government, with the intention to be the first vice president.
The month of January, you were still the Minister of Labour in the transitional government of national unity. How is the government operating? We hear people have not received their salaries. The economic crisis is just biting left and right. Could you tell us what is happening there?
You know, John Tanza war is a t-shirt of violence, and it is very expensive. So the economic activity in South Sudan is very difficult. So I think it is out of secret sometimes to get easily the salaries or basic salaries of the civil servant. It is difficult. But sometimes they do struggle in case if they get money somewhere or royal money, where they pay sometimes. And every 3 months or 2 months, people live without salaries. So it is about war. When you have insecurity, you cannot mobilize your potential resources that can lift it up the country.
How many times did you receive your salary during the time you were a minister?
During my time, I think they tried the level best. I remember people meet only for the year. For the part of that year, people miss only 3 months. And the current Minister of Finance is really doing well. Only that the problem, there is no resources, there is no money, there is no reserve. And when the country has no reserve, where do you expect to get to pay people all the time? The little money that are there sometimes, the regime is looking after feeding the army so that they can fight back the forces of opposition.
The reasons where you decided to leave the government, you gave 8 reasons. Reason number 3, you say there is forceful disappearances, arbitrary arrest and random killing and torturing and abduction of suspected IO members. And you went on saying that there are 15 Kenyan members of parliament who are calling themselves friends of South Sudan who are behind this kidnapping. Could you tell us more?
There was a group of 15 MPs that went to Juba and they came out openly that we are friends of South Sudan. Anyone that will talk about to topple or either mobilizing a population in Kenya against the government of South Sudan, such a person will risk either deportation or arrest by Kenyan government. I don't know why they call themselves friends of South Sudan.
Lieutenant General Gabriel Diouf-Lamb is the former National Minister of Labor, Public Service and Human Resource Development of South Sudan. He spoke with viewers John Tanza. The Cameroonian government has announced that the General Certificate of Education, GCE, examination will proceed as originally scheduled. This despite ongoing teacher strike in the English-speaking parts of the country. The strike has forced some school closures. Some parents say they will not send their children to school while the government has deployed security operatives in the community. The Catholic Church administers several schools with thousands of students in the English-speaking parts of the country. Bishop Andrew Fuanya Nkeya is head of the Mathi Diocese. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that heads of religious schools in the English-speaking parts of the country have been meeting with parents and officials of the government to resolve the ongoing educational impasse.
The resolution of this problem is in the interest of the private and confessional education because government teachers initiated this strike, but now they are receiving their salaries. Meanwhile, the Catholic schools, Presbyterian schools, private schools can no longer pay salaries. I have close to 380 teachers who are looking up to me for salaries, but I don't have school fees to pay them. It is a matter that the parents have to take the decision. The church has been doing a lot to start dialogue with the parents, dialogue with government.
So with this communique issued by the government specifically saying examinations will go on as originally scheduled, wouldn't this impact negatively on some of your students whose parents are telling you that they are not going to bring the awards to school? How will this play out?
It is the government's responsibility to educate its citizens, and we are helping government in this responsibility so as to give a broader choice to the citizens to have whatever education that they need. Our doors are open, but if the children don't come, their parents don't bring them, there's nothing we can do. So we have been talking to the parents, we have been talking to our teachers, are most often in campus, but there are no students for them to teach.
Bishop Nkeya, when you interacted with some of the parents, what was the overarching concern, apart from the fact that they would not bring their children to school, as they told you, due to the presence of security agents or security officers in some of these institutions that you oversee?
The parents were very, very clear to me. The issue is not just rebelling to be. Of course, they want their children to go to school, but there are other underlying difficulties which they think they are facing, and they're expecting government to answer some of those problems. Like they spoke about the overbearing nature of some of the administrators. And to tell you something, the parents in Mamfe went as far as opting to contribute money to give me to pay teachers who are not teaching, to pay my teachers, but they will not send their children to school. This is how serious it is. So it is not a joking matter. It's a very serious problem.
As a pastor, and I know you are interacting with other pastors and the clergy in the English-speaking areas, are there any other efforts that you are putting into place to resolve some of these concerns with the government?
Yes, we have had meetings with the Baptist and the Presbyterian leaders. We have also had discussions with the four ministers of education, with the prime minister and other high officials of the country to dialogue on the issue. First of all, to make them know the reality of the issue on the ground as it is. And secondly, to bring up whatever suggestions as solutions that we have. And the same way, we have also been dialoguing with the parents, with the teachers. So we stand in the middle to really facilitate dialogue in this issue. And like we say, at no cost should dialogue stop. We should continue dialoguing, because if dialogue stops, then we are trapped. There's no way we can get out of this situation.
Bishop Andrew Fuanya Nkeya is the head of the Mafe Diocese. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Mafe, Cameroon. It's time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with the Federation of International Football President Gianni Infantino, who is saying FIFA's main mission is to develop the game of football on the African continent. His comment is coming after the Federation's three-day football summit that ended in Johannesburg yesterday.
When it comes to football development and when it comes to infrastructure projects and so on, I've already come to about 10 African countries. I'm traveling now in the next few days to another 5 or 6 countries, and I'm learning still as well on what the needs are. But you can be sure that on a country-by-country basis, we will develop the necessary project, which will be tailored, so we will be able to present concrete results on a country-by-country basis on what impact we have had in Africa.
And ahead of the CAF presidential election, Nigeria Football Federation President Amaju Pinnick has once again voiced out his support for Madagascar's Ahmed Ahmed, who is the sole challenger to the long-term ruling Issa Hayatou in next month's Confederation of Africa Football presidential election. In Ethiopia, the NFF president said he was joining forces with those advocating for a change in the leadership of the continental ruling body CAF, because people want change and a new generation of leadership.
I just feel at this point that there are post-election differences between Gianni and Issa Hayatou that to me are irreconcilable. And I've come out to say, yes, I'm supporting Ahmed Ahmed from Madagascar, and I don't have any regrets about supporting him.
The Nigerian Football Federation becomes the first dominant voice after the 14-member Southern Africa regional body COSAFA endorsed Ahmed's candidacy. And FIFA President Gianni Infantino will have a chance to watch Ugandan football raw talent on Saturday when he heads to Lugogo Stadium to watch KCCA under-17 play Luenza under-17 in an organized friendly match. Infantino will engage President Yoweri Museveni at the State House upon his arrival before embarking on more football-related activities on Saturday. In volleyball news, the Algerian men's under-23 volleyball team qualified for the World Championship in Egypt after beating Mauritius 3-0 in Algiers in their second match of the men's under-23 African Volleyball Championship. And finally, homeboys winger Oscar Ayodi and Kenya Hakulin Frank Wanyama have made a return to Kenya 7 squad for the World Rugby 7 Series in Las Vegas and Vancouver. Kenya 7's head coach Innocent Simuyu said Wanyama and Ayodi have been drafted to replace Oscar Uma and Brian Taga, with the rest of the team unchanged.
I don't think Argentina and Russia can match us in terms of physicality on the breakdown. But New Zealand will be a tough physical battle because they can run and they can they're quite physical in their approach at the breakdown.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale from Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts and Trivia Question for today, February 24th. On this day in 1864, Rebecca Lee became the first black woman to receive a degree as a medical doctor. Also on this day in 1867, Howard University was created by Congress. Also on this day in 1940, former world heavyweight boxing champion Jimmy Ellis was born, James Albert Ellis, in Louisville, Kentucky. Ellis won the World Boxing Association title after beating Jerry Quarry in April of 1968. On this day in African history in 1966, Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana, was removed by the military. He was out of the country on a peace mission to Vietnam in Southeast Asia. Also on this day in African history in 1961, Dr. Louis Leakey discovered human-like bones in the Old Duvai Gorge in Tanganyika, which is today Tanzania. The bones are believed to be the ancestors of modern man. And on this day in African history in 1949, after 42 days of bitter debate, Egypt and Israel signed an armistice on the island of Rhodes. However, several contentious topics, such as the status of Beersheba in the Negev Desert, were dropped from the final agreement. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 24th. Congratulations to Isa Ibrahim Nyamonge of Mara in Tanzania, Winston Kampala of Kasongu in Malawi, and Ebilomba Joel Davison of Karu in Nasarawa State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 23rd question. African-American Douglas L. Wilder was governor of which U.S. state? The answer, Virginia. Now, here is our question for today, February 24th. Which African-American played a part in the construction of Washington, D.C.? Once again, which African-American played a part in the construction of Washington, D.C.? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Authorities in Gambia have arrested the former head of the National Intelligence Agency, which has been accused of systemic human rights abuses while it was under the control of ousted former president Yahya Jammeh. Officials say Yankuba Banje and eight other NIA employees were arrested on Monday. No specific charges were listed. And that's it for this Friday, February 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Hello, Mambo! This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This Sunday, treat your ears to a luscious hour of African music. From new, fresh, hot airway hip-hop to Tuareg rock and roll to island fusion of the Seychelles, I've got it for you! Plus, in this edition, live music and interviews with amazing artists from Zanzibar's 2017 Sauti za Busara Festival. All this and more just for you, peeps. So tune in this Sunday, 1500 and 2000 UTC, right here with me, Heather, on Music Time in Africa.